Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Other F Word Podcast. We are here with Wynn Tran, and I can tell you, you know, because we talk a little bit before we start these things, and we have been laughing, and this is going to be a good one, so stick around. Tell us exactly how you describe yourself in the one word. You are the biggest.
I'm the biggest fuck up I know, but and I understand that that's really funny, but I really do feel like I'm just such a fuck. I worked in film. I worked in food. Two of the most illogical businesses in the entire fucking world. Yeah. And like, who's stupid enough to do that?
That's what we do. And now you've got a restaurant, Button Mash. You've got a book, Adventures in Starry Kitchen. I mean, look at you.
Failing upwards.
Love it.
That's what we do. Man, so we're so excited to dig in and hear your story. And, you know, because I love people. I think one of the things we love in this show is when people are really honest about their failures and not trying to kind of sugarcoat them or make, you know, when they're just, bam, I totally get that from you, which is why I'm so excited to talk to you.
It's really, really rough. And the hard, you know, the funniest thing is, so when I pitched the book to my publisher, who actually pitched me, I told him to fuck off. That's part of the story.
it's a good way to get a book deal.
Well, because they called me 3 days after. So I quit. I was at an emotional high and a professional low. We quit the business 2.5 years ago. And when we quit, my publisher, HarperCollins, HarperOne, they're pretty big.
Yeah.
I don't know why they made the mistake of calling me. they called me 3 days after I quit. They're like, hey, we just heard about you. We don't think you're going to go away. And I was like, that's great. I don't give a shit. And they're like, do you know who you are? Like, yeah, you're Lord of the fucking Rings publisher. Like, I don't give a fuck about that either.
By the way, he drops the F-bomb way more than I do.
Even more than Melissa. We love it. Melissa,
yeah, I have a passion and emotion, though.
Yeah, we love it.
So let's step back. So you're what did
right
you
place.
Quit from? I mean, you succeeded
at
the MCAT.
You got to tell your story about your underground restaurant.
Oh, there's so many stories.
Yeah. So when you say you quit 2 years ago, what were you in your emotional high professional?
Well,
we
were in a restaurant in Chinatown. So Roy Choi, who is, I consider the godfather of the current food movement in
LA.
Oh,
yeah, for sure.
He's a friend of ours, and he was like, hey, Wynn, you should move Starry Kitchen to Chinatown. I just moved there. He has a place called Chago. I'm like, dude, I'm not fucking Mr. Kogi. I can't just move and people show up. And
Mr. Kogi.
Yeah, I was like, Mr. Kogi. But I did. And we were like, wow, Chinatown's pretty cool. It's been dormant. And it was us and Chago that moved into Chinatown before the current resurgence of Chinatown now in the last 2 or 3 years. And we moved all the food presses. Like, holy shit, there's something happening in Chinatown. I'm like, what do you mean? It's just us and Kogi. Like, but you two are pretty phenomenal. And at this point in time, we were already, we got on. So Jonathan Gold's our foremost food reviewer here in LA, right?
Jonathan Gold.
Yeah, but we were on the Jonathan Gold 101 best restaurant list.
Wow.
The year before. And, you know, to give you, if you want to, you know, do it statistically, there are 30,000 restaurants in LA.
Right. Yeah, that's a big.
There's no probability I should be on that list.
A big win.
It's
that's
a dream
big,
come true,
yeah.
though.
Yeah, well, I also told Jonathan, I appreciate that you hit save on the wrong file and you sent it to the publisher before the deadline. So I won't tell anyone else. But then what happened was when we were in Chinatown, we got on the list again and we got more accolades. And then, you know, at this point in time, you know, I always tell my staff I've been hot shit and not shit and everything in between. And this point in time, we'd been not shit for 2 years. And, you know, fighting through it, it started getting us to be hot shit again. We're like, we earned it again. And it was hitting and was busy. And Chinatown became this thing for us. We were next to the Bruce Lee statue. But, you know, it's amazing.
That's big.
Yeah,
that's
if you like people call, like, where are you at? Like, oh, we're in this. Like, I'm just like, do you know the Bruce Lee statue? It's like, yeah, I love that thing.
That's fantastic. And what a landmark.
It is a great landmark. It's made of bronze. That's relevant to people. People are listening. Like, what is this Bruce Lee statue made of? Really?
Amazing.
Is it porcelain? Is it ceramic? I'm all over the place.
Funny. So you made it back up there.
We made it back
down.
We made it back up. But what happened in the course of all this, that I've accepted bad deals in haste, and it's hard for people to really understand this unless you're my staff. Part of it is because I feel like the people we employ, we owe it to them. To, you know, they make a living off of us. And I've made bad deals in haste to keep them employed. Mm. And I've sacrificed myself and my wife in doing that, which I know everyone that's married is like, why would you do that? You're an asshole husband. But I see the bigger picture. Like, I believed in Star Kitchen so much that I was like, we will work it out. I'm an eternal optimist. Ultimately, like, it's, I'm also a weasel. Like, don't worry, we'll figure it out. But that comes with being an optimist.
A little Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, you trust.
Yeah, exactly.
Ferris Bueller. Yeah.
You trust the process. You trust that something will happen for the good if you keep going.
I trust humanity. I'm naive, whatever you want to call me, but I just see good things happen more often than not. Even, look, it's not to say I don't see bad shit happen. It happened to me enough where I've reflected on it many times over. And what happened was that after being in Chinatown for 2 years, my wife was like, look, I can't take this anymore. We got to either shut this down or we're going to do it our way and raise enough money for what we need to do. And I led, you know, a Kickstarter to raise 500 grand, which everyone thinks is a lot of money. It is. But part of it was to educate people on running a restaurant. Like, that is not enough money, actually.
Can you explain more specifically what were the bad deals? What was it that you're referring to when you say you couldn't do it anymore? How are things being run, and what was the bad deal? What was it that was having such a negative impact?
It's a long story short, we started out of our apartment, it exploded. We opened a lunch restaurant in downtown 2.5 years. That exploded even more, got us in New York Times, New Yorker, all this crazy stuff. But then we parted ways with our partners who sold the space, and then we came up a pop-up after that in the Fashion District. That was the first time I took a deal out in haste. And the deal was basically the financial split of how, who takes what. And I agreed to it in haste. And that it's so complicated, I can't even explain that to you. So, but that was in the Fashion District. So that we were there for 2 years, and then eventually we're like, let's go to Chinatown. I'm a fan of the handshake deal. And it's not to say, and I'm a fan of contract. I used to do contract negotiation in films too. So, but here's the thing I usually tell people, especially when I used to represent people to sell films. I was like, look, at the end of the day, if someone wants to screw you, a signature is not going to fucking hold them back.
That's so true. Yeah. That's so true. Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Contract is nice. You can go to court. But what happens is that if that person has deeper pockets than you, they're just going to outlast you.
Yeah.
Just to win. And they're going to spend more money on the attorneys than paying you. Yeah. Just because they can and they want to.
Yeah, right. That's very true.
So, and I took a handshake deal, which everyone, I'm sure, is like listening, like, oh my God, this guy is so stupid already. And it was good. But what happened was in Chinatown, without divulging too much, you know, there was a change of heart in how the deal was structured, and they changed it on us. And I could either, be like, fuck this and just shut it all down. But that it's that responsibility. You know, everyone that... It's really easy to run away, and I'm just not that kind of person. And not to make myself sound like some kind of moral cowboy of some kind. It's just I can't sacrifice everyone that's working for me just because I am unhappy with what's happening. Well, so I have to carry the weight.
You have ethics.
But no, I want to know why it is that you seem to be so unafraid of failure. Is it because did it happen over time, or did you start out that way? Was it because you came from such a conventional, like, sort of not conventional, but you came from a background where there were such defined expectations, and you knew early on that you weren't going to meet them, so you just thought, fuck it, I'm just going to burst out of it in flames? And
I don't know if I'm in that insightful ever, but, you know, the simple answer to that is anger. It's the real simple answer. And I remember I was in junior high in seventh grade, and I took this like a career test, and it tells you what your career is going to be. And the first thing it said is like, there's a designation whether you're going to be a leader or a follower. Mm-hmm. And it told me I was going to be a follower. And that pissed me off so fucking much. Like, you know, I already knew I was a quiet kid at that point in time, and I was really shy, and
that's
I was
social awkward.
Yeah, well, look, you overcompensate. But that was the catalyst. Right. There are everything you experience in life makes you who you are.
Totally.
Right, and that test, like, it just made me, it made me a ball of emotions, because I was so sad. Like, you know, I know this is who I am, but why do I need a test to tell me that? And that made me so depressed, and that made me angry. And then all of a sudden, I think I took that anger and redirected it, and just like, you know what? Fuck this. I can't be that person. And it's successively just things like that where, you know, and, you know, I hate to put this to you guys, but like when I grew up in Dallas and predominantly white society, and I feel like I was always inferior. And then eventually I was just like, fuck this. Like, this is all bullshit. Like, I can't feel like this all the time. Mm-hmm. And just always standing up for myself more and more and more, and just getting more confidence doing that. And the epitome of this really is, like, in college, I eventually somehow got convinced to run for the student government, which I didn't think I could do. And I became the vice president of the student body of UT Dallas. And there's 25,000 students. And which is phenomenal. I didn't think that was ever anything. I've always been taught to be humble and, you know, with, you know, to appreciate humility and never speak out. And I just started. And we, in 1999, we started this online teacher evaluation site, which is basically a Yelp for professors.
Oh, wow.
Jeez. And the state of Texas, the Office of General Counsel, and by the way, in the country, the two largest school systems are the UC system, the University of California, and the UT system. And the UT system really does not fuck around. And they sued me for libel and defamation. Because they are like, you know, the only people that are going to review their professors are people that hate their professors and love their professors. And we're like, no, that's not true, but it's absolutely true. We knew that.
Yeah. You get no in between.
Yeah. And the crux of the story is my young, you know, Pakistani American friend who's a total rebel rouser. He's a shorter guy than me. His name is Mo Butts Kashmiri. he grew up in Arlington, Texas. I grew up in Carrollton, Texas. And he goes, and we have to go in this room with 12 attorneys. And it's a video teleconference with 12 attorneys. And by the way, you know, 12 Texas attorneys, imagine like trophy wives, trophy husbands. And and they're always saying like, boy, like talking like that. Like, they don't all talk like that, but I promise you, some do. Like, what do you think you're doing, boy?
That's like a scene out of a movie.
It's intimidating. No, but I grew up with stuff like that. And like, that's not a joke. Like, it's respect and demanded. That's the culture. And we went in and they were like, we're going to sue you for libel and defamation. You need to stop now. And then I'm nervous as fuck. I'm like, I don't know what it means to be sued. And then Mo, and this is in the book too, like Mo all of a sudden is like, what are you going to sue us for? Money? We're college students. We don't have money. And he just starts laughing. And I'm like, and I start nervously laughing, like, yeah, I don't have money either. I don't know what I'm doing. But remember those Sprint commercials? Remember when the silent is like a needle and it drops? Yeah. It's like a pin?
Yes.
That's exactly like a deafening silence from this crowd. And all of a sudden, we calm down, they calm down, no one says a word, and I'm thinking, oh, shit.
We're going to jail.
No, we just got away with it. Because the conference ended right there. Like, there was no other words after that. Like, that ended the entire argument.
Case closed.
Like, wow. It was a threat the entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The threat of being sued was supposed to scare us into submission.
Right.
We didn't submit.
You guys were smarter.
I don't know if we're smarter as much. And my friend was smarter, but it's more like we push back.
Right.
And what happens is that when you do that enough, you push back, you realize, oh man, I don't have to take it.
Right. Well, that sounds like you realized that when that career test came in, labeling you as a follower, that you realized then, wait a minute, I don't have to be what other people want me to be, or I don't have to do what other people are telling me I have to do. It's pushing back.
In essence, it's that, but it takes a lot. The book's helped me a lot because I had to think about all those like kind of instances in my life have led to that. But, you know, I've been bullied. I've been made fun of. I've been both emotionally and physically and it's not something I wish upon anyone, but I just couldn't take it anymore. But the weird thing about this too, and there's all these weird tangents. Like, I remember I used to get made fun of in daycare before I'd go to kindergarten, so much so that, at this point in time, this is really relevant. Like, the original Wonder Woman to me, it was Linda Carter.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
When I was getting made fun of, I would spin around. Like, remember how Wonder Woman
right.
changed?
I remember that spin.
Yeah. That would get me beat up a lot more because they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm changing into Wonder Woman. But one of those kids that used to make fun of me in sixth grade, his name is Jeff Smith. He's a friend of mine now. He just came up to me. He's like, look, Wynn, I am so sorry. He's a sixth grader. He's 12 years old. He's like, I did not understand.
Wow.
Like, I just didn't. I don't know why I was making fun of you. I didn't know why we beat up on you and stuff.
Because you were different.
Yeah. And he's like, I just got caught up in the moment. And I've gotten to know you and we've become friends. And I just want to say, I'm so sorry about all that.
That's powerful.
It's a 12-year-old?
Amazing.
Yeah,
that's
like, incredible. I know adults that are my age, almost 40, right.
Still
can't,
not,
yeah,
totally.
Can't deal with that.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So it's things like amazing. that you know, that was a positive in my life. That really shaped who I am. So it's those little things really resonate later on in life. So it's like, you know, I've had a lot of the bad, but there's those really strong good moments that I really cling on to.
Right. Well, it's cool. Like, it's shaping who you are, but also I feel like it's letting you be who you already were. Mm-hmm. That was kind of hidden, that you had, you know, kind of hidden. So I love that. It's like you becoming yourself.
Yeah. You it's
kind of getting the, where the balls. Were you, where were your
What were your parents like growing up in terms of?
My parents worked really, they both managed 7-Elevens. They weren't around most of the time. They worked about 6 to 7 days a week to afford me a better life. Wow. And, you know, one version of this that I tell people, and it's the only story I actually have for my mom, she's telling me about the Vietnam War. My parents emigrated from Vietnam in the 2 weeks. At the end of the Vietnam War, the VC, the Viet Cong, allowed anyone from Vietnam to leave without any question. My mom was 17. My dad was 16.
Oh.
Can you imagine that? Like, I was worried about getting laid. I didn't get laid, but I was worried about that. And when I was 16 or 17, working as a bag boy, my parents left the country that they knew, like, jumped on a boat for 2 or 3 months, not knowing where they would go, whether they'd live, dealing with famine, rape, pirates, and all that kind of stuff.
Terrifying.
And, you know, and my mom had said, look, you know, this is the reason why I left Vietnam. Like she said, like, one time she was a kid, and in her village, the VC started digging up a hole, and no one knew what it was. And they gathered up a lot of the elderly, and they buried them alive.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
And she's like, and this is why, number one, why I can't tell you anymore about the Vietnam War, because it's just so horrific. Number two, this is why I've moved to America for you. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty deep.
That's really,
right? And
really.
Yeah, so that, you know, and this is part of the reason why I work so hard, too, is like, you know what? No matter what my fucking complaints are, I've never had to deal with that.
Right.
And hopefully I never will see that.
Right. Yeah,
it's horrific. Yeah. War is fucking. I mean, she, by the way, she left when she was 17, so she saw that when she was like maybe 11 or 12.
Oh, God. Too young to process.
That's too much.
And did she leave her whole family? Was she with your father at that point, or was she completely on her own?
She was on. She was just friends with my father. She left her entire family. She's the only sibling, and her parents, like, everyone stayed in Vietnam.
So she was dealing with all the loss of her family, just leaving them.
Yeah, she left. She has like 9 brothers or 9 sisters, 1 brother. She left all her siblings. Because she just couldn't deal with it.
How
and
brave.
It's very brave.
Well, that, clearly it runs in the family. Like, that's, you know, there's a connection.
Why owe it to them?
I was just thinking that.
No,
like,
but,
what? Well, I could imagine what that message is to you, which is, you know, they sacrificed so much loss, and yet they had to save themselves. But you are probably this hope of a different way to live, of a new of a new life.
Yeah.
You know?
Is that pressure, though, or is it something you take on willingly?
I take on willingly. I mean, I don't feel like I have pressure, and like I think the thing that comes my way, I just accept it. I'm, and maybe that's my entrepreneurial spirit or like that. Like, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, I have to deal with that. I'm like, yeah, I just have to deal with it. Like, I had a kid recently, like a year and a half ago.
Congratulations!
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
It was to the club.
It's a great accident. Mm-hmm. I love him.
Great accident.
Love Killian. But it's funny. Is like when you have a kid, you get these two questions. They're very common. Which I, and maybe just me being weird. Everyone's like, are you excited? Are you scared? And I'm like, I'm neither. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I'm just zen. And then like, what do you mean about that? It's like, he's coming into my life and I accept that and that's it. It's like, why do I need to be scared or excited? Like, I'm excited, yes, but I'm not like he's going to be part of my life and I'm just going to accept him and he's going to move forward.
It's going to be the new normal, which is what happens.
Yeah.
So that kind of outlook on life, was that taught to you or shown to you, or do you think that's just who you are?
No, I don't think that was taught or shown to me at all. I think it's who I am, but it's also because of my yearning to learn more and go out, experience things. And I think a lot of it came from, you know, just working, doing philanthropy when I was growing up and then finally traveling. My first time I went to Vietnam or out of the country was when I was 18. I traveled internationally, not for vacation, but for perspective. For me, it's really important to be grounded and regrounded and to meet people with a lot less that are much happier than we are. And it just gives me a lot more, I don't know, appreciation of what we have. And like, you know, I said before, like it makes me feel like we're self-entitled, but again, it's not, it's to appreciate what we have and to give back and to maybe work harder too. Like, you know, if we want what we want to help inspire other people, you know, we can complain less and do more. I just think people complain too much. I mean, that's just me. And I'm sure people are complaining about me complaining.
About complaining.
Yeah, it's a waste of energy too.
But it's a great point. And again, we talk about this all the time. When you're failing or feeling like a failure, what grounds you, what helps you hold on to what's really important, you know, and not losing sight of that. So finding ways to get grounded.
Yeah.
You know,
to cope.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you a different story that I talked about with someone yesterday, literally, like, you know, I had a friend of mine who had never divulged this story of why she had the worst day in her life, but I have a feeling it's something to do with sexual assault. And she told me once that, you know, I have now experienced the worst day of my life, but every other day is better than that. So, and that's my perspective. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ever dig, like, it's not my business, but I got that kind of feeling. I was like, you know, that's a great perspective. Like, when you finally hit rock bottom, or at least the rock bottom you've hit, like, even if it's you having a bad day, if it's not close to that,
right,
or if it's not that,
right,
then you're all right.
And that, yet you, that requires you to be really conscious, you know,
correct,
of and have an internal dialogue and know yourself so that you could be present enough to say, wow, it's not that bad.
Well, the hard part, and I say this a lot now too, is that there's just such a stigma about failure that people, and it's also the connotation of the word right now. There's nothing positive about that word, right? Like,
that's why it's the other F word.
That is the other F word. Like, I imagine, like, and maybe this is just me growing up in the 80s, like, I imagine, like, the Karate Kid, right? And the Cobra Kai's, and failure is not an option.
Right.
I love that movie so much.
But that plays those tropes.
So true.
Those tropes are really, really, it's really clear, right? Failure is not an option, you know? Okay. Mm-hmm. And that is, and then people come away with that something different. Like, they come up with this inflated sense of confidence, and that failure is just something that's like, that doesn't happen to people. Like, doesn't happen to winners.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, if you think about it. I mean, people don't want to admit their failures, but it's really because they're worried you'll think less of them. So it's kind of coming from an insecure place.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I think you'll think less of me and won't love me.
Yeah.
You know, if I have failures.
Which is kind of what you said when you first sat down, which is that you're like, I'm a big fuck up and I'm okay with that because it somehow does make you more confident because you're like, I'm okay with it. This is who I am. And I know I've failed. And I think there's also that element of learning. Like, you mm-hmm. failed and fall on your face, as you said. How did you put it? You fell on your face.
My face is so mangled that I don't care
exactly,
anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. I love that.
It really is not mangled.
I'm not even close.
But it's nice because you don't have to spin.
It's great skin.
I feel like, you know, you can stop spinning and you can just be yourself. You know, like, spinning the story of like, look, I'm doing all this great stuff. You know, you can just be honest with people. Well, I think people respond to that.
Well, and that's really why I do that, right? Like, I feel like my job in my life now is to inspire people, whether it be positively or negatively. Like, I say negatively, meaning that if I anger someone so much, like when I was a kid, to go do something, that is great. You're doing something about it. But the reason why I say I'm a fuck up also is to lower the bar for people. When they're real, you know, I hope it's kind of like when I was watching Married with Children when I was a kid, like, you realize that your family's not as dysfunctional mm-hmm. as the Bundys. It brings your family together. And
so
that's, that is, but that is what, that's
all perspective.
Like, if you want to analyze it, that's part of it. Yeah. Like, oh my God. Yeah. And that's, when I do that because I want people, like, because I think people are smarter than me and more successful than me. And sometimes they need that perspective, even if they're unhappy. Like, oh man, this guy, he thinks he's a big fuck up and he has like a book and stuff like that.
Right.
Like, well, maybe I can do better than him, which is great. I want you to.
Right.
It's so true because it's not seeming like it's something impossible to reach when it's this notion of success that's so untouchable and unreachable. You think, well, I could never get there. That's not me. And I can't relate to that. Whereas people like you suddenly make it seem reachable and doable and attainable because it's like, wait a second. Yeah, I can relate to this guy. And I mean, that's kind of what we're trying to do here as well, is dispel these notions of, you know, success, what it means to be successful and what it means to be a failure. And we're all failures, and that's not a bad thing.
No.
And it's just shifting our perspective on it, I think, which I love. I love the way that you're doing that and how you're talking about it. It's right up our alley.
I'm trying. Like, I've been very lucky in the success we've had, and the success we've had, strange enough, has not been financial, which doesn't have to be the metric of success too. And like, I'm at a different point in my life too. For me, success isn't even as important as completion.
Mm.
To be able to close the book on something and learn from it, and mm-hmm. that for me is the real success.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken me a long time to get to that mentality, you know. But I'm so much happier in doing that. And actually now when I have a son, like, that's why I want my son to understand. Like, I don't want him to shun failure. I want him to grow as a person, and I want him to understand that he's going to affect the people around him.
Right.
And to take that responsibility to kind of pick them up, and hopefully they'll pick him up. And this, you know, it'll be it'll be vice versa. Like his friends might be more successful than him and they'll pick him up.
Right.
Right. Those are, and then you know, I worked in Hollywood for like 10 years and those are my favorite stories are like, you know, writers and directors that, you know, whether it be like Quentin Tarantino or something like that, like they pick up a lot of their friends.
Yeah.
And people are like, why? It's like, because they're friends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And they want to inspire the people around them. And they also recognize the talent that their friends have, even when they don't see that, too.
You know, and again, we hear that a lot in this podcast about collaborating and bringing people in to help you through it, whether it's during your success or while you're failing.
Yeah.
You know, to have to not do it alone.
It's important to have a support system. Yeah. And I, for me, I have an intern now. And I, you know, when we were talking,
that would be fun.
It is, but, and she's like, do you have a lot of interns? I'm like, no, like, I only take interns that really want to do it because I'm not an easy person. But I, you know, I told her, and to be honest with you, like, I like having interns because it's reciprocally inspiring. Like, you know, inspiring people is one part of it, but seeing growth in other people is, it's that's my payback.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. You know, whatever your tit for tat is, and you want to, like, for me, like, it's never, it's immeasurable, but I love meeting people that have come back to me and be like, you know what? I heard your story. I started out in my apartment, or like there's this guy that used to come to my lunch restaurant for 2.5 years and we were downtown and there's all these law firms and this guy came every day and he's like, dude, I'm so inspired by you. It's like, I can't believe you're doing it. He's like, I'm thinking about leaving my law firm. I'm like,
Wow.
Oh no, don't do that. And he's like, I'm like, don't you have like law school loans? He's like, yeah, but I'm just so inspired by you. And then a year later, he's like, dude, I'm doing it. I'm like, you're doing what? It's like, I'm leaving because of you. I'm like, no. His name is Minaj Shah. He has this thing called the Fashion Law Group and he's still on his own like 5 years later.
Wow.
And that for me, and that's part of the reason why I also don't really quit. Like even when I quit, I felt like I was betraying the people that we've inspired.
Yeah.
Because like, it's like a lie. Like, I don't think we've reached the true wall yet and I need to reach that full wall. So, and then when I quit, you know, I can tell the people that, you know, whether they care or not, like, look, you guys, we've made it pretty far.
We did it.
You know, we did it. And, you know, we know this, you know, we've moved on to the next chapter of our lives and I hope you guys continue. Don't quit what you're doing too.
What would that wall be, you think?
I don't know. It's hard because I'm so risk accepted. That's a term I learned.
I was just going to say, because you don't have fear.
Yeah.
No. So risk accepted. I like that.
I like that too.
Right? Do you have fear?
You started a restaurant in your apartment.
Do you feel fear or do you just push through it?
No, I feel fear all the time.
Yeah.
And it's what drives me. But it's the hard part is I have a son now. I get I have responsibilities, but I don't feel like the normal rules of society, it's really hard for me to articulate this because I think people are in their heads going to say, well, don't apply to them. Like, no, I don't think that's actually true, but I have a different interpretation of it. So you said something really profound that hits a mark that I always think, like, I think other people are always worried about what other people think. But the funny thing is if you survey any individual person, for the most part, no one actually thinks that opinion that other people quote unquote think. Right, people are worried about what society thinks, but as a whole, but individually, no, they're like, no, I'm fine with it. But you know, worry about Sally. Then you go to Sally, like, no, I'm fine with it. Worry about Bob. Like, well, I just talked to Bob about it. Well, I'm fine with that. And it's weird that this there's this aura of opinion that doesn't really exist, but everyone thinks it is. So you know, for my son, I got to be responsible, and that's the fear, right? Like that, if I risk too much, that he can have my version of stability, then that might be the stopping point. But I also feel like if, you know, as a kid and you watch movies or read about stories and if I'm supposed to instill in my son to chase after his dreams, and this is not me judging anyone else, it's just my personal opinion. If I'm actually not doing that, then I'm living a fucking lie to my child. Yeah. And then I'm not going to teach that to my child,
right.
Which is fine. I think that's all right. But I think because I think children are far more observant than people ever know. And I remember being a child just watching everything around me.
So true.
Because they're not clouded about anything.
Right.
And they can see when you're hesitating.
Yep.
Yeah, right? They can sense it.
And they can feel when you're not happy.
Yeah.
Right.
But and I think what I'll do, and now I'm talking it through, like I think what I'll do is I'll probably convey those in ways that my son will understand. Like, so what's going on? Like, well, daddy's chasing after his dreams, but he's hit a roadblock because of this, this, and that.
Yeah.
And talk it through with him. So we understand. So it's not like I don't want to lie to him. And he's going to figure it out anyway.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. We talk about that a lot. Is you know, being truthful with kids to teach them about how to push through hard times.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what a lot of us adults didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can reverse that and teach them so that we can't, they can't avoid failure. We don't want them to, mm-hmm. but we want them to be prepared to learn through it and not avoid it.
The hard part is I'm Asian and we're not supposed to talk about it.
Right. That's true. There is that cultural element too. Gosh.
Yeah.
Cause I was thinking, my thought as we were, you guys were just talking, was that it's such an American thing. It's such an American, sort of pressure that everything has to be, you know, we have to be the winners and the best and, that there isn't really any room for failure. And that that's been a problem, I think, for this, the most recent generation of kids, our kids, I'd say kids in there, I don't know, in the last 10, 20 years, mm-hmm. maybe, anyway, less than that. But kids who were taught, that, you know, failure is not an option. And yet, you're saying that that's not just an American thing. It's Asian, very
well, the Asians,
Asian
it's even like every culture is very specific, but I always say, and it's hard for me to convey this to my staff. And I try to explain this to them, but like when I grew up, it was never good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the hard part about that is there was no in between and or no interpretation for that. So when you're a kid and you're hearing that, you feel like you're just not living up to the standards of your parents. But what it really means is don't accept mediocrity. Don't be complacent.
Right.
Realize there's always more.
Right.
Right. And that's the hardest part to convey to people because trying to balance success and failure. And it's not really failure. It's just that, oh, like, you know, I would get like an A, like, great, you should get an A+. I'm like, this is not good enough. It's like,
yeah.
No, it's not good enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. And, but there's no conversation to explain that.
That's right. What I was going to ask.
Yeah.
So there was not that narrating or talking through it with you.
No.
It was
no.
Just, here's the expectation, go do it.
Yeah. Go do it.
Right.
Because you, and the version of that, the way I can articulate it is that my father saw more potential in me. So I hope he did. at least, but it's, you know, that, and that's like, I'm actually dealing with that with my staff currently. Like they're very sensitive towards critique. And I just got wind of this and I have to break down the walls because I'm pretty tough with my staff. I curse a lot when it comes to it, but, and they take that
channeling Gordon Ramsay a little.
No, I don't. But like, I've talked to you guys, I'm very passionate.
Yeah.
But, and I have to help articulate to them, like Gordon Ramsay's different. Like he, and his TV persona may be different than his real persona from what I've heard too, but he does call people. I don't tell people they're donkeys, which I think would be fucking hilarious. Anyway. I just like that word anyway, but, I just like, look, this is fucking horrible. This is this and that. And I finally figured out how to articulate it to my staff. And I'm going to give them the bigger picture. It's like, look, either I can be honest with you and we can fix it now, or I can give you the HR version of this and it will take 4 weeks for us to figure out whether you're going to leave or you're going to stay. Like, and that's just me. Like I'd rather just be honest with people and then work through it versus giving you the, well, you know, Jim, it was all right. You could do a little better.
I like that because I was going to disagree with what Sarah said, which she said over the last 10 years that now failure is not an option for kids. Because I think we won't allow people to fail anymore. You know, so I think failure, you know, it's not like you can't fail. It's like, no, you did great. Even when you failed. You know what I'm saying? So I think what you're saying...
You mean everybody getting a trophy?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's slightly different. So I think I like what you're saying, that honesty of like, hey, let's get you where you want to go. You know, let's get you either there or...
But my point is I guess I didn't explain it well, because what I mean by failure is not an option is that it's still not being discussed. So I totally agree that the notion of like, everybody's a winner, everybody gets a 9th place ribbon, you know?
Yeah.
And good job about everything is a fear of failure. It comes down to a fear of failure, which is, you know, something that I think is, as I said, very much, I think it's always been around and it's clearly not just an American thing. It's, you know, comes out in different ways in different cultures, but, that fear of the notion of failure is what I think underlies so much behavior and,
right. And the inability to tolerate negative
anything,
emotions.
So I think, you know, even if you got this isn't good enough, which is in some ways at least more honest and real than, hey, you're a winner when you're not, it was never talked about. There was still sort of some shame around failure, right?
Yeah, but shame. But there's the flip side of what you're saying too. Is I'm trying to get my staff to understand. So here's a small anecdote. I had a sous chef, and he used to create new stuff all the time. And I didn't realize this until he created this donut, and I was like, "Holy shit, this donut's fucking amazing!" And he turns over to my partner, is like, oh shit. I'm like, it's like, what? Like, Wynn has never given me a compliment in 2 years.
Oh.
But no, no.
But when it comes, when it's real.
It's genuine.
It's genuine.
That, and that's
right.
The thing. Like that. And yeah. it, at first I was like, oh man, I feel really bad about that. I was like, but I don't, because now you know it's genuine.
Right. Totally.
Now right. You know.
So you said you've been horrible for 2 years. You just did something
I never
good,
did that.
But it's hard to, I think it's hard for people to tolerate authenticity because it's not always pretty. It doesn't always feel good. And yet when it comes, it you can trust it.
But you've earned it.
Right.
Yeah,
that's why you can trust it. Right. Yeah, it's real.
And that's the thing that I think people want success all the time.
Yes.
Right.
They want to feel good all the time.
But that's it right there.
The appreciation isn't genuine.
Right.
And it becomes really false. And then what happens is, necessarily, they don't necessarily go into the real world, but they go into a different situation where people are a little bit different. They're like, well, I used to get this all the time. And like, well, guess what? You're not going to get that here. And then they're kind of mentally messed up and they think it's not them, it's the other people.
Right. Totally. There's no accountability.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a lot of that. People want to take accountability and responsibility. Like my wife and I have this issue too. Like every time we have issues with our staff, I now look like, well, what could I have done? She's like, well, no, you shouldn't. Like, no, I can, because I manage these people. And if I'm not giving them the tools for them to succeed and they're failing because I didn't tell them, then that is my responsibility. Right. And I don't like that all the time, but managing people is as much energy as working.
It is. It's a big job. Well, I'm thinking as you're talking about this, that, it's kind of like parenting, you know,
it's exactly like
you're parenting the staff.
Yeah. And you have to have a level of self-awareness, to really kind of bring out the best in people in the way that you do with your kid, I think. So you're so thoughtful about all this stuff and you seem to be constantly, self-critical, or at least not critical, but like self-aware and trying to understand yourself and improve. And I think that's fantastic.
I'm trying.
That's all we could do. Now, before we have to wrap up, can you just go back and talk a little bit quickly about how you started your restaurant in an apartment illegally lunch in 2 seconds?
Because
I think it's really just an inspiration.
Well, the fall of the economy was in 2008. We started an illegal underground restaurant at our apartment because we were both unemployed in 2009. Our apartment became the number one Asian fusion restaurant listing all of Los Angeles on Yelp later in 2009. Last time we were at our apartment, it had 130 people from our apartment span 3 hours. We got caught by the health department. I didn't give a shit and ran it for another 3 months. And then we took over a sushi restaurant that became the legit version of Starry Kitchen. And we have been failing upwards ever since. Like, all the stuff that's happened to us was not part of the plan. There was no plan. We just needed to make a buck. Everything that we've done has happened out of necessity. And that's the most important thing for me to tell people. Like, you know, they get inspired by our story. I'm like, look, you have to do it. It has to be genuine to what's going on with you. Like,
absolutely.
Just being creative isn't always enough. You can't have an open slate. You have to have an actual, not in the goal, like, your father or your parents set a goal. It's more like, I needed to make money. We're going to do this. We're going to do this our way. And we're going to fail doing it. We're going to succeed doing it. And we're going to see what happens.
You already gone against the lawyers, man. So you knew. You went against the Texas.
Like, we still have no money. So you can sue us for nothing.
And by the way, that's happened to me more recently, too. Like, I was like, were you going to sue for money? Like, but now I do that because, like, let's work through it. Because I know you want money and I don't have it yet.
I love it. Well, it is so inspiring because you were true to your dream and pushed through it, even if it was not conventional, maybe not even legal, but found a way.
Maybe not totally legal. Well, I hope you know your listeners will pick up the book, because I wrote the book also as a handbook for all the fuck ups that we've done to inspire people to either start an illegal underground restaurant or to inspire them not to run a restaurant. Or inspire them in general. Like, it's a memoir and cookbook, and all the recipes have like anecdotes of how much of a fuck up I am in between them too.
Oh wow!
So great. We can't wait to read it.
Yeah, it's fun. I've spent 2 years of my life on it, so I hope people don't hate it too much.
Where can they find it?
Wherever books are sold is what I'm officially supposed to say.
Okay. And where can they find more about your restaurants?
StarryKitchen.com. You can go to Instagram, Twitter, Facebook at Starry Kitchen. Write me whenever you feel like. If you want to troll me, I will troll you back for fun.
I love
trolls. They make me laugh.
Well, yeah,
they don't usually laugh though when I troll them back.
Well, we're taking a field trip and we're going to go eat some of those crispy balls, hairy balls, what are they?
No, they're not hairy balls. Our balls are hairless.
Hairless.
Crispy tofu balls.
Crispy tofu balls.
Not hairy balls.
No, not hairy balls. 25% less sweaty and salty, though. So you swirl in your mouth, they're far more enjoyable than average. Hashtag fact.
Hashtag fact. All right, we're going.
Please, enjoy them in your mouth, our balls. Thank you.
Thank you for
Thanks
coming.
Thanks so much, man. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.